Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Jesmyne Ward, author of the very moving memoir, Men We Reaped. And we'll also talk with Beverly Hegry about her love of Jane Austen and the Jane Austen Society of North America. Jesmyne Ward possesses one of the most powerful and admired of New Southern voices. She is the author of two novels, Where the Line Bleeds and Salvage the Bones, a starkly beautiful novel about Hurricane Katrina, which won the National Book Award. For her third book, she's back with a personal and searing memoir, Men We Reaped, and it is a must-read. Jesmyne grew up in DeLisle, Mississippi, where she lives now, and she is an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of South Alabama. Jesmyne Ward, welcome to The Reading Life.
It's good to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming back.
No problem.
Now, Jesmyne, so many people have talked about the astounding numbers of young African-American men who die at a very early age. I mean, I remember when Lewis Edwards wrote his book, N, about this very problem. And this is a story you might easily have turned to fiction for, but it was personal to you, and so you turned to nonfiction.
Yeah, I thought about attempting to write about, you know, my brother and my cousin and the other, you know, young men that I knew that died, like attempting to write about that in fiction. But it was one of those things where I'd been through enough workshops that I knew that if I tried to tell that story as fiction, that people would doubt the veracity of the story. They'd say, there's no way that this can happen in real life, you know? And I think that that is what first sort of prevented me from writing about this in fiction and fictionalizing it. But I do think that, you know, in all my fiction, in my first novel and my second novel, especially with the relationship with Esh and Skeeta, I feel like in everything that I do, in all the fiction that I've written, I've always been writing towards my brother in some way. Like, I feel like he keeps popping up in the male characters. So I sort of feel like I've been doing that already. And, you know, it was time for me, you know, to draw from fact, I guess.
Yeah. So tell us about your brother.
He died when he was 19. You know, his birthday is at the end of October, and he died at the beginning of October, so he was almost 20. You know, he was 3 years younger than me, and we grew up, because he was closest to me in age. I have three siblings. There are four of us, full siblings. And so because he was the closest to me in age, you know, we were each other's best friends when we were growing up. Somewhere in our teenage years, all of a sudden we switched roles and he became the older brother and suddenly I was the younger sister, because there was so much that I felt like that he was, I just feel like he matured faster than I did, which is weird because they usually say that it's, you know, girls that, you know, mature faster, but I feel like he was made to mature more quickly than I was. And he taught me a lot before he left. You know, I miss him very much. And even though I've written an entire book about him, I think that writing the book helped me maybe to understand him a little better, but I don't think that I'll ever fully understand him. And I know, you know, as I write more fiction, because I'm returning to fiction after this, I know that as I write more fiction, again, I'll probably be writing towards him in some kind of way. I know he'll pop up, but I don't think that I'll ever fully understand him, you know, because he was a complex human being.
He's your mystery.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And so tell us about the other young men you lost. You lost so many people in such a short time. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of thing that would send most people to their knees.
Mm-hmm. So one of my friends that died, he was the last friend, but he's the first that I write about him in the book. His name was Roger. We called him Raj for short. We spent a lot of time at his house in the summers that I write about. You know, he had a great sense of humor. If you ask people about him, the thing that they remember first is his smile. But I feel like, you know, that like rambunctiousness and that capacity, you know, to make people laugh, I feel like that masked something deeper, mm-hmm. you know. And he had his own demons that he was struggling with in his life. And so I feel like that jocularity sort of masked that. Let's see, who else? Damon, he was the oldest of the young men. I think he was in his early 30s when he died. So he's older than me. I mean, and his story reflected that, you know, because he had a child, he had a fiance, you know, he wasn't involved in anything illegal, but he was trying to make ends meet and really hustling to make ends meet by basically taking any kinds of jobs that he could get. But then in the end, it didn't matter, unfortunately, because he was sort of shot and killed, and his murder hasn't been, it's never been solved. My cousin CJ, of course I knew my brother the best. You know, I spent most of my time with my brother, but then out of the other four young men that died, I think that I spent more time with CJ than with the rest of them, but partly because he's my distant cousin. And then also he and my sister were really close and they dated. You know, so I spent a lot of time with him, and it's almost like he was sort of like the opposite of Raj. You know, like on the surface, in my interactions with him, he didn't crack a lot of jokes, and he wasn't, you know, sort of funny and warm and welcoming. He seemed sort of harder on the surface, I feel like, and maybe a little bit more reserved and sometimes quieter. But I think there's sort of the same thing going on where the personality that you see on the surface is not, it's
the reality. You know,
yeah, it's not the reality. And he could be very kind and very, you know, sort of honest. And I think that when that happened, that it would always sort of surprise me, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he died in a car accident. Oh, and then so the last young man beside my brother is Ronald. I didn't know him as well as I knew the other young man. But what I did know of him, you know, he was very handsome. He was very charming. And he knew it. But then, of course, you know, that confidence that I saw on the surface, again, you know, all these young men had hidden depths. And then I think that that confidence that I saw masked, you know, he was struggling with depression. Mm-hmm. And he lost his struggle with depression, and he died by suicide when he was young, when he was around my brother's age. So, you know, they were all my friends. And I think that each of the deaths was very much a surprise. It's not as if, you know, we thought that they were engaging in behavior that would lead to them dying the way that they did.
One of the things you capture so beautifully in this book, I think, is just what it's like to be young. What it's like to be young and to have friends and people you care about so much, and then to be growing up together into this world that seems determined to slap you right into reality with racism, poverty, everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a whiplash thing.
Yeah.
And you've created this amazing metaphor for your hometown of the wolf as Wolf Town. Mm-hmm. How did that image come to you?
Well, you know, there's this plaque in DeLille after you're done sort of crossing over the bayou from Pas Crescent and you entered into DeLille, and there's one of those historical plaques. You know, it wasn't part of the lore that my grandparents sort of handed down to me about DeLille being called Wolf Town back before it was called DeLille, but it's something that I discovered on the plaque, because the plaque said that it was originally called Wolf Town, and that caught my imagination. I just, you know, there was this spark, and I thought, you know, what I was writing about, right? All of my friends dying so early, you know, my brother dying so early, so young, and this feeling that we'd come of age with, where there was this awful mix of, like, careless sort of teenage attitude and this, like, I don't know, maybe like a fatal confidence. I don't know how to describe it, but this awful mix between teenage daredevil attitude and then this really fatalistic attitude, which I think the reader really saw with CJ, right? Mm-hmm. Who felt, you know, from a very young age that he would die young and would tell people, I'm not going to be here long. You know, I'm going to die young. And so I read that on the plaque, and then I was thinking about this overwhelming, pervasive, this darkness that I felt like that we encountered, you know, throughout our lives, and that really sort of overwhelmed us when I was in my 20s and I began losing, you know, I lost my brother and lost to my friends. And so for me, you know, that darkness, it seemed perfect to personify that darkness with this wolf.
Right.
And so that's what I did.
Now, with the loss of so many young men, women have had to rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And that's something you do celebrate in this book, is women's strength.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about some of the women in your family.
So I think, you know, the sort of the central woman in this, you know, besides me, because I'm the narrator, is my mom, you know, because she found herself in her late 20s with four children that she had to support on her own. And she found a way, and she did it. You know, she worked very hard. And then what's awful for me when I think about her entire life is when I think about, you know, that that wasn't just the only part of her life that was hard. Like, I write about her childhood and how my mom's mom worked really hard to raise her seven kids. And because she was always at work, then that meant that my mom, had to be the mother figure for them, you know, and my mom was making meals for them when she was like 7 years old, 6 years old, and responsible for her brothers and sisters from that age. And then, you know, her relationship with my father fails, you know, their marriage fails, and then she has four kids to raise her own. And then my brother dies at such a young age. So my mom is really, she's really one of the strongest characters in the book, because I think that she's a great example of, you know, and her story is, it's not atypical. I feel like it's not. I mean, I look at my grandmother's life. I look at, you know, the mothers of the other young men that died. I look at, you know, just in general, the other women in the community that have had to pick up the pieces and also hold the families together and hold the community together.
Right. And writing this memoir, writing something like this, you know, in the writing of it, you're going to cause pain.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to bring back terrible memories. Mm-hmm. And yet you seem to have been supported mm-hmm. and loved through this mm-hmm. really hard process.
Mm-hmm. I was. I mean, I know that there are some, you know, especially as more people in my family and in the community read the book, there are some people who I think would rather that I hadn't written the book. Because I tell some very hard truths, right? But it seems like the response, the majority of the people in my community, in my family that have read the book, have supported me and, you know, do think that it's a good thing that I wrote this and that it's a story that people will hear and will read. So, yeah, so I have encountered some of that, but I think that overall the response has been really encouraging.
Yeah. And also during the writing of this book, you had a daughter.
I did.
Now, how has that changed the way you feel about the people you're writing for?
Near the end of the book, I specifically like acknowledge the things that my mother taught me, you know, what her real legacy to me was, you know, versus what I thought it was when I was younger, right? And then I say that, you know, that I hope that I can teach these same things to my, you know, to my own daughter. And so I think that, you know, having a daughter has given me that perspective where I'm able to sort of look at my mother and see her as a mother, you know, because I'm a mother. But I do also think that having a daughter has also, of course, made me more fearful in ways. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I feel like when I encounter people that do have problems with, you know, me revealing these very personal, private things about us and our lives, my response to that now is my nephew is 17 now. And I feel like if we don't begin talking about these things and it, or if we don't contribute our voice, you know, to the conversation that is already happening about these things, right, then I have to worry about my nephew. I mean, I've already been worrying, but then, you know, if we don't address these things, if we don't admit that there's a problem, if we don't acknowledge this, then it will just continue happening, you know? And so having a daughter has really brought that home to me and made that realization even more visceral for me.
Oh, well, I wonder if you'd read just a little bit for us from the end of Men We Reaped.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
We who still live do what we must. Life is a hurricane. And we board up to save what we can and bow low to the earth to crouch in that small space above the dirt where the wind will not reach. We honor anniversaries of deaths by cleaning graves and sitting next to them before fires, sharing food with those who will not eat again. We raise children and tell them other things about who they can be and what they are worth, to us, everything. We love each other fiercely while we live and after we die. We survive. We are savages.
So beautiful.
Thank you.
I think someday outside DeLisle, next to that plaque, there'll be one that says DeLisle, Mississippi, home of Jessamyn Ward. That's what should come next. We've been talking with Jessamyn Ward, whose stunning new memoir is Men We Reaped. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Beverly Hegry is one of those good all-around book people you see at bookstores, at festivals, or in book groups. And we decided it would be fun to talk with her about her love of Jane Austen. She's a member of the Jane Austen Society of North America and attended their national meeting last fall. Last year was the bicentennial of Pride and Prejudice, and this year, in 2014, we marked the bicentennial of Mansfield Park. Beverly is a registered nurse who came to New Orleans in 1972 and was a docent at NoMA and now is a volunteer in the NoMA Library. And she belongs to three book clubs. Beverly, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
So, Beverly, why do you love Jane Austen so much?
I like Jane Austen so much because I find her writing very clever. It's satirical, it's ironic, it's comical, it's easy to read, and it's all about courtship and marriage, and she has happy endings.
Yes, she does. Now, there are only six novels to read. I mean, so you must have read them more than once.
Yes, definitely. Persuasion happens to be my favorite.
Mine too.
And I've read it several times.
And you've always done this just for pleasure. This has never been like an English major's, you know, routine for you.
No, I've always read her for pleasure.
And then how did you get involved with the Jane Austen Society?
It was through Debbie Wehmeyer at the Garden District Bookshop.
Oh, yes.
In the late 90s, she was the coordinator of the Louisiana region of the Jane Austen Society of North America, and she used to talk about it. And in the year 2000, the annual meeting was going to be held in Boston, and that is when I joined JASNA and became a lifetime member and went to Boston. And that year was also the topic of the meeting was Pride and Prejudice.
And so the Louisiana group now is our little portion of that bigger society.
Yes.
So what do you do with in that group?
We meet four times a year in the spring, in March. We have a speaker. This year, the president of JASNA, Iris Lutz, is coming to talk to us about Jane Austen's house in England, where she and her sister and mother lived for the last years of their lives. And that is a house called the Jane Austen House Museum. It's in Chawton. And Iris is going to speak to us and show us slides of Chawton.
Have you ever been to Chawton?
Yes, I have. I went, I think, the first time in 2002, and this past summer I went again, and it's just a lovely little village. You take the train out from London, it's only like maybe a two-hour ride, and her house museum is open, and the Chawton House Library is open. Jane had a brother who was adopted by a wealthy relative, and he inherited an estate, and that house was bought by a member of JASNA, and it is now a library where scholars can go, and it also is open to the public, and you can have guided docent tours.
Oh, nice.
I did that this summer because it wasn't open the first time that I went, and it was absolutely wonderful, and it's such a beautiful little village.
Do you have an image of her as a person in your mind? Do you imagine her?
Well, yes, because I can imagine her face, not the rest of her body, because the only remaining
image
of her is her head, and it's at the National Portrait Gallery in London. And so I went to see her again this summer before I took the trip to Chawton.
There's something very special about standing in the actual place where the author wrote the work, don't you find?
Yes, and in the dining room at the House Museum in Chawton are the little table that she used and also the chair that she sat in to do her writing. And so it's quite moving to be there.
And the whole idea that she would write and then hide her writing.
Yes, when she heard somebody coming.
You know,
and that. The door squeaked into
the
that
early
room.
Warning system, is that it?
So she knew someone was coming.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So do you have special copies of her books that you like? Do you collect her books?
I have a set from London, the Edinburgh edition, about 1902, I think it is. A nice leather-bound edition. And then I have, I think, two of the books, Emma and Pride and Prejudice, in the Heritage Club editions.
Oh, those are pretty.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
Sometimes it's fun to have more than one copy of your favorite book. I mean, Jane Eyre is my favorite book, so I have the first one I ever bought, and then I have progressively nicer ones, you know what I mean?
Well, what I bought this year was the annotated Pride and Prejudice, which are really kind of fun to read. It slows you down, but it explains everything.
And maybe then you know it all.
Maybe words that, you know, are out of style in this day and age.
Now, tell us about your book groups. You're in three different book groups.
Yes, I have one book group that was formed 21 years ago with friends of mine.
Wow.
And then I belong to the New Orleans Museum of Art Book Club with Sheila Clark.
Oh, they do great books. It's so interesting.
Yes. And then I go to the Garden District Bookshop Book Club.
And that's been around for a while, too, now. But 21 years for a book group with friends?
Yes, it was 21 years this year.
Isn't that interesting how long they can last? There's some book groups in New Orleans that are 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. So tell us what sorts of things you do with the society.
We have four meetings a year. The first one will be Iris Lutz, the president of JASNA. That'll be March 15th. Then in May, I believe it's around the last Saturday in May, we will have a tea. And then September 28th, the last Saturday in September, we will have a discussion of Mansfield Park, which is the book that we're reading this year because it's the 200th anniversary of Mansfield Park. The meetings are held at the Rosa Keller Library from 2 to 4 in the afternoon on Saturdays. Then we have a very special event in December. Jane was born on December 16th, 1775, and we celebrate her birthday with a luncheon at Commander's Palace.
Which she would have loved, don't you think?
She would have. She is there with us in spirit. We have a champagne toast to her every year. And it's just an absolutely fabulous event.
So can anyone join the Jane Austen Society?
Yes, anyone who loves to read, who loves Jane Austen, anyone who maybe has never read Jane Austen and would like to is certainly invited to join.
Excellent. How many members do you think you have right now?
We have, I think, about 23 active members.
And they're all devoted Janeites. I love the word Janeite, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Beverly Hegry, who is a devoted Janeite and a devoted reader as well. Thank you so much, Beverly.
Thank you, Susan.
For more information about the Jane Austen Society, check out the website JASNA, JASNA.org. Oh, I've always wanted to work in a bookstore, people say. And maybe so, maybe they think so. But it's not all fun and games and reading. And that's what Neil Young tells us in Bookstore Rap.
You know what I used to do before I did this? Before I ever did this, you know what I did? I worked in a bookstore for 2 weeks. I shouldn't say this kind of thing in public. Admit to it. But actually, about 4 years ago when I was working at this bookstore, I used to be really uptight about working in the bookstore because I used to have to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and walk to work, and it was in the wintertime. And I used to, all I did was carry, the guy with the truck had come, and he'd come down this ramp. I go, I'm dropping them all, and everybody's yelling at me. And then I had to take them out of the cartons and mark down what they were and lick stamps and put them on each one, 79 cents for this one, and then carry them out and put them on the shelf. And that's what I did, right? So you can imagine that I didn't get behind it, you know, too well on the natch. So what happened to me was I got fired for irregularity because I couldn't be depended on to be really, you know, I couldn't be depended on to be consistent. Because every once in a while, this girl that I knew in Yorkville Village in Toronto would lay one of these little red pills on me. Now, don't tell anybody about this, okay? She said they were diet pills. But they were really great diet pills. I didn't eat anything all day. Didn't even break for lunch, man. I was piling those books, just getting right into it, piling them up and, you know, stamp and run out. It was great. But the next day I'd come to work. Right? Couldn't move a book. Didn't even want to see a book. And books made me, you know, I never want to see another book. And then 3 days later, I'd be there catching up and getting 3 days ahead. And he finally fired me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The West Bank Writers Group meets every Tuesday at 6 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Gary Joyner, an associate professor of history at LSU Shreveport and author of many Civil War histories, presents a lecture, War Comes Home, The Civil War in Louisiana, Tuesday, January 21st at 6:30 at the Weinman Auditorium at Metairie Park Country Day School. Rick Barton signs Courting Pandemonium, Thursday, January 23rd from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Love books? Love monster trucks? You can see the monster truck Spider-Man, Friday, January 24th from 3:30 to 5 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The first 100 people to donate a minimum of 2 books to Friends of the Jefferson Parish Public Library will receive 2 tickets to the Monster Truck Jam Saturday, January 25th at 7. This event is part of the regional Turn the Page Literacy Campaign, sponsored by the New Orleans Public Library. Today's guest, Jesmyn Ward, signs her memoir, Men We Reaped, Friday, January 24th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents Homefront, Battlefront, Louisiana and the Civil War, the 19th Annual Williams Research Center Symposium. That's January 24th through 25th at the Hotel Mondrian. Check out hnoc.org to register. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, January 26th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Lavender Ink authors Jeff Munsterman, Nancy Dixon, Megan Burns, Jimmy Ross, Jonathan Klein, and Chris Champagne appear Sunday, January 26th from 2:30 to 4:30 at Faulkner House Books. Black History Month is coming up, and the New Orleans Public Library is sponsoring an essay contest for 7th to 12th grade students. The topic is Blacks and Reconstruction in Louisiana. The deadline is January 24th. For more information, check out neworleanspubliclibrary.org. Or, if you're an artist, enter the Black History Month 2014 Poster Design Contest. All entries will be judged on creativity, artistic merit, and best representation of this year's theme, Civil Rights in America. Entries are due to the African American Resource Center at the Main Library by January 29th. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.